Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey everyone, John Wertheim here. It is this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast. It is also the first week of Wimbledon, he says wistfully. Our guest this week is Donald Dell. Donald is a former player, a promoter, a broadcaster, an agent. He has worn many hats. Not unlike Bartholomew Cubbins, he has also worn many at once. Donald is still a force in tennis. He wrote an op-ed recently in the Washington Post about the prospect of combining the men's and women's tours. So we talk about that. We talk about where tennis is right now. And as a bonus, Donald signed Michael Jordan out of North Carolina. And especially after The Last Dance, we talk about Michael Jordan. So some non-tennis bonus coverage on Michael Jordan and a lot of good tennis talk. Here's Donald Dell.
I appreciate you doing this. How are you? How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. We've been lucky. I've been home here since about March 15th, but my two daughters, their husbands, and our two grandchildren, 5 and 7, are about 30 yards from where we are.
Man, it's like a 120-day Thanksgiving. It doesn't sound bad.
Yeah.
Let's, I don't know. I mean, I got a couple things to bring up, but I did want to talk about the op-ed you wrote, and I thought you'd be a good person to talk about with the tour merger, which has been eclipsed lately by COVID and the U.S. Open, but this was sort of a hot topic. And everyone says the same thing, which is, great idea, the devil's in the details. So let's advance that. How do we exercise those devilish details? How do we push through so this becomes more than an abstract good idea that we need to negotiate? What do we do to make this happen?
Well, I think more than that, the devil is in the leadership. In other words, I think it's going to take strong leaders in both groups to get it done. And I think Steve Simon and Mickey Lawler, you know, are really veterans and well-respected and well-liked. Gaudenzi, the new chairman of the ATP, I'm told is very smart, very capable. And I just think if they wanted to really do it, they'd get together. And then it takes a lot of support from, you know, Billie Jean and Roger and some of the leaders in the game all got behind it. Then it's sort of like all the protests out there today. You know, you got to move the ship forward, and it's a big alphabet soup that everybody sort of fights for their turf. I mean,
right.
The ATP Tour has really established itself, but it's not part of the Grand Slams. It's not part of the ITF, and not that they want to be. Don't misunderstand me, but I just think recently, in the last 6 or 8 years, the ATP Tour has not worked very effectively in some senses because they've been voting in blocks. The three tournament directors vote together and the three player reps vote together. And then the chairman's left there with the hanging vote. And literally, he doesn't want to vote because he always makes one side unhappy. And the last two chairmen, if you reviewed it, John, have been fired because the one group didn't like how he voted and they need a super majority of 4-2 to extend his contract. So his contracts ran out in the last two cases. Now, I'm told by people that I'm very close to and respect that Gaudenzi is quite a different person. He's a very strong leader, very smart in media, and he really gets it. I just think for the sport, it would be really helpful to have the two groups merge on a simple basis. And the when you talk about the details, you're right, but I think the simplicity is what matters. Keep it simple, stupid, when you want to merge the two to start with. You don't have to have exactly the same boards, the same voting members, but come in and merge it and have, you know, five or six basic principles. And truthfully, we found out in Washington with the City Open that I ran for 50 years, literally, for the WTEF, the Washington Tennis Foundation, that we had a men's only event for 42 years. And then City came along as our title sponsor and rightfully said, look, 51% of our clients, bankers, are women. So we're not going to sponsor it unless you'll bring a women's tournament into it. And we did, but it was a problem because there's a bigger women's event at Stanford for 700,000. We were only allowed by the rules for 250. But guess what? The ATP, the minority of the ATP, 10%, fought it tooth and nail. They didn't want an integrated tournament. And I had to go before the board, you know, three different times and swear up and down that we'd give them favorability on the scheduling of the center court, scheduling of transportation, scheduling of practice courts. And it just didn't work. It's working okay. And the women, the best women, like to play Washington. But now under the new WTA rules, we can only sign one of the top 20 in the world in order to protect the other event that's raising more prize money by 700 or more. So those kind of problems have to be worked out. And the ATP Tour really needs to get stronger with its membership. The vocal minority, which is really only about 10 or 12%, and it's always the complainers on the tour. The tour board knows who they are, and they're always ranked between 150 and 300. But they're the ones that are putting tremendous pressure on the player council not to have more integrated events, which, of course, I think we found the women were a tremendous asset to the tournament. I was surprised by that, honestly. And we got tons of phone calls about what time Sloan was going to play, and you know what time the gal from Canada who was so attractive and such a good player. Everybody was asking the same questions. So the women really integrated well into Washington, even though they were in a second-class position, because we had to sign agreements with ATP in March before the tournament about the center court scheduling and about transportation. I mean, literally, we had to sign a memorandum that we wouldn't do certain things to make it totally equal. Right. And nobody wants to hear that. Everybody's going to yell and scream, but that's what happened.
The I mean, you know, the irony is, as we speak now, it's unclear if women will be at the DC event in 2020 for very similar reasons. But I mean, just sort of big picture, do you think in 2020, this equal distribution of board seats between players and tournaments reflects a balance of power in tennis? I mean, do you think tournaments and players should have equal representation in terms of board seats?
Well, I'm, you know, I helped start the ATP in 1972 with Jack Kramer, and it was a players-only union. And we had the Wimbledon boycott in 73, which none of the players today even know about or remember. We had 68 players withdraw from Wimbledon after they made the draw, made the seedings, and they wouldn't let Nicky Pillage play because he refused to play Davis Cup. And the ITF said, no, you can't play Wimbledon. Wimbledon mistakenly accepted that. And 68 players led by Cliff Drysdale, Arthur Ashe, Stan Smith, John Newcomb, Rod Laver, Ken Rosewall, all the best players in the world, pulled out of the 1973 Wimbledon championships. But what did that do? It unified a players' union because they had skin in the game. They had given up a lot to pull out. Stan Smith is the only defending champion in the history of Wimbledon who could have played the next year and didn't play. You go back. Only wars have interrupted that thing, but Stan chose not to play. And so we had a very strong union in the 70s and 80s. suddenly there was a whole nother political battle, and the MIPTC council was canceled in 1989 when we won the Volvo lawsuit about them. And Hamilton Jordan was the new head of the ATP, and he suddenly decided, because he lived in Ponte Vedra, he's very close to the PGA people and the tour, and he said, let's have a tour where we have players and tournaments, 50-50 equal representation, and we run a new thing called the ATP Tour, and we'll run all the tournaments. Some parts of the tour have been extraordinarily successful for the players. But your question, John, I would have much preferred a tournament directors association and a players association, labor and management.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, and then meet every 5 years and negotiate a collective bargaining agreement so that you can run the sport accordingly. But at the end of the day, a better question is, how do we make America, tennis in America, much more popular? I mean, what drives me nuts, and this is why I think a merger of the two associations, now that they're structured, or you restructure the ATP into players only and tournaments only, which I think is probably too big a problem. But it's a partnership now that sometimes doesn't work. Why? Because the tournament directors sitting there all have stake conflicts of interest with their own tournaments that they represent, and they want players. But basically, the players want, you know, fewer tournaments for the top players and bigger money, and the tournaments want more tournaments and less prize money for the. So there's a conflict structurally in a lot of ways. I'm hopeful and positive that Galdenzi may overcome that. But to answer your original question, if we had two separate player only and tournament director only representation, I think that's a better, more equal, effective way of getting the game bigger, John, because in Europe, as you know, soccer's one, some countries basketball's two, but tennis is in the top two or three in every country in Europe. Well, and it's number, you know, 11 or 12 in America.
And
on
that, you can see that reflected in the rankings.
Exactly.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Let me ask you this. You were a longtime agent as well. A player comes to you and he says, you know, Donald, you got to help me here. I'm the world's number one player, but my ego got a hold of me. I put on this exhibition during COVID. I wasn't particularly cautious. People got sick, including me. I'm getting hammered worldwide here. Help me get my good name back. What would you tell this hypothetical player?
Well, the hypothetical player is pretty obvious, John, but I would tell him, first and foremost, you know, make a really public apology for your stupidity, the way you dealt with the problem, and then turn very hard to changing your mind and trying, you know, before all this happened, the hypothetical number one player, you know, said, I don't believe in vaccinations. I don't want to come to the U.S. Open because I can't bring but one person and my entourage is five. And I would just, it would be very easy for him to turn that around if he came out publicly and frequently to really support what the sport is trying to do in light of the virus. I mean, we have a terrible situation, and the players are certainly the lesser players. And by that I mean, say, from 30 to 120, they can't afford what's happening. The top 15 certainly can, but the next 75 are really hurting financially. And I think this hypothetical number one player should speak out very strongly and very frequently on how to make it work under the circumstances. For example, support the U.S. Open, support the French Open if they're held, with or without spectators, because then at least you have jobs and players and television, and the television ratings with no spectators are going to be substantial. They'll be enormous, in my opinion.
Right. Let me ask you a non-tennis question. You and I have been speaking over the past few years for this 1984, but for this book and Michael Jordan that I've been working on. And I was curious, did you watch The Last Dance? Did you watch the documentary?
I did. I watched all of it.
What was that like for you?
Well, some of it was really exciting. I thought that Michael did a very, very good job.
Yeah, right.
That, you know, the NBA had films that were magnificent. And the only thing personally that I didn't like much about it was that I personally signed Michael in 1984. Dean Smith called me on a Saturday morning with Michael and his mother, Dolores, on the phone. And asked me if I wanted to represent Michael. And I said, sure. He was a junior. And then Michael was on the phone. I said, Michael, how do you feel about it? And he said, well, I'm a junior. I really want to come back for one more year, but coach says I should come out now. And, you know, my mom and I were thinking about, what do you think? And I said, well, let me test the market and find out what teams would pay and where you might go in the draft. Because, John, you got to remember, in 84, there was no rules. I mean, you couldn't sign or even say you had an agent or you were going to be ineligible. So Coach Smith always used me to talk to general managers, and we envisioned that Michael was going to go 2 or 3. I thought he might go after Olajuwon, but they in Portland drafted Sam Bowie. And so, you know, I managed Michael in Washington with Pro Serve for 9 or 10 years till 1992. Personally, and he was phenomenal. As a marketing agent, the first thing we did was put him in a tuxedo holding a basketball, and we tried to cross over all color lines in order to market him, and he was tremendously successful. But so as I watched The Last Dance, you know, I had mixed emotions about some of it, but I thought that the NBA and ESPN did a wonderful job by using the right films. I mean, when you see Michael playing the Boston Celtics in a playoff game where they have 4 Hall of Famers in their front line.
Right.
Michael scores 63 points. And after the game, Larry Bird says, you know, we can't stop him. All we got to do is score ahead of him because he's the best player who's ever played. That's pretty persuasive. And I think it was a wonderful thing for Michael getting his name remembered because people forget very quickly. And, you know, people like players like LeBron James comes along. He's a great player, and everybody, you know, it's like the Rod Laver, Roger Federer, who's the best player. Well, they're better in their eras, not necessarily head to head, but what they did when they played in those eras, in my judgment.
I got one more, Jordan, which is everyone talks about how he was so charismatic and funny and giving of his time. And one of the reasons he was so popular early is just he was so accessible, and you had this wonderful smile, but also this wonderfully engaging, magnetic personality. What do you think happened that turned him into a bit of a cipher? I mean, I think one reason this was so popular is because nobody really knows much about Michael Jordan. He doesn't do interviews. He doesn't do shows. He's not Charles Barkley. His ownership hasn't been particularly successful. What do you think happened? Was there one moment, or what do you think the forces were that took this charismatic, accessible guy and made him so introverted?
Well, first of all, a couple things. Number one, he is very charismatic, and he does have a great smile. That's a given. When you walk into a room and you meet people, and he handles himself very well, he never had drug problems. He never had drinking problems. He never had any problems except he loved to gamble about anything. But he was very charismatic. On the other side of the coin is Michael was driven. I mean, he is the most vision-oriented person to accomplish goals that I've met in sports. I mean, you know, he's playing a team sport. And in tennis and golf, you meet people who are, you know, a guy like Roger Federer or Djokovic. I mean, they're driven. They give up a lot of things around them because it's an individual sport. Basketball is a 5-man team sport. But Michael was driven and put everything aside to be the best he could. I don't know what drove him to do that, but he turned down everything to be the best. And the second thing that made him, I think, more introverted was you have no idea how much he loved his father. And when his father was killed, murdered in his own car in North Carolina, that really stunned Michael. And I think it hurt him in a lot of ways. And it probably made him a lot more untrustworthy of people around him. I mean, you know, I recruited a lot of players over 40 years. I loved basketball. And we were very strong in basketball and tennis at ProServe. And I remember Michael, the first day I ever met him, he came to my home in Washington, spent the two nights with us, and his father, James Jordan, came with him. So I had an unusual opportunity to get to know James a little bit. No recruit had ever done that. Phil Ford came up, James Worthy came up. They all came and met us, but nobody brought their father. And so he was really, I think, I don't know this, this is my opinion from afar, that he just really became more introverted in trying to drive himself to be as good as he could. And he knew after 3 or 4 years that he had a chance to be the greatest because everyone's telling him that. And his results were so outstanding. I mean, to think that he won the championship 3 years in a row in the NBA, 2 years off to play baseball, which was a lark, comes back and wins it 3 more years. I mean, how many people can do that?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's an interesting sort of parallels to tennis, where sometimes it's obvious where a player's drive comes from. And there was a childhood, or there was deprivation, or there was, you know, sometimes the loss of a sibling. I think the film did a pretty good job of this too, but this is a pretty middle-class kid with, you know, two.
No, but trust me.
Siblings and the happily married parents.
John, trust me, his drive came a lot from his father, James, and his mother, Dolores, who was a big, big factor in his life. And his siblings, Larry was a guy he used to compete against in high school. They used to go out and battle. And I mean, ESPN captured some of that, but that was accurate. I mean, Dolores and James Jordan were really, not only did they create Michael, but they really molded Michael in their own way. And love of his family was a tremendous point in his upbringing. There's no doubt in my mind. And he also loved Coach Smith. I mean, the father figure was a big deal in Michael's life as a youngster.
Right. All right. Back to tennis. I think when you're on the inside and no one is more inside than you are, you hear a lot of complaints and the fan age is going up and it's been almost 20 years since an American man has won a major. And yet I see the two highest grossing male and female athletes in the world are tennis players. And, you know, the U.S. Open can pay full prize money without selling a single ticket. And, you know, as a woman's sport, tennis is head and shoulders above anything else. I mean, I think there's some positives. I mean, big picture, where do you see the sport in 2020?
Well, I don't see it going very anywhere in 2020. You got to build to 2021. If this rebound comes of the virus in August or September, I mean, it could set everything back, not forward. I mean, I think, you know, when I heard the Masters in golf was going November 10th to 14th, I thought, God almighty, that's awful long. It's going to be cold. Well, in Georgia, I guess you can do it. That may have been the smartest play of all, because maybe some of this will be in the winter, will die down by November. But I would look, John, towards 2021 and what the sport, look, no major sport is a great international sport without a big, strong American audience. The women in America have done great. The Williams sisters have been phenomenal and have done a great job for women's tennis for 10, 12 years. They've carried the sport.
Right.
But, you know,
right,
on the men's side, you know, we have 4 players in the top 100 ranked on the ATP Tour. I mean, that's absurd. John Isner, who's a wonderful guy, is 34 years old. He's ranked 24. He's the highest ranked American. And he does very well financially in the game because he's the number one ranked American. But then the question is, how do you make American tennis more important to the young athletes coming out of the ghetto, coming out of the cities, coming out of the farmlands? Your great natural athletes, there's a battle on when they're 8, 10, 12 years old. And do you choose an individual sport like tennis, where the riches are enormous? The women have all done that because they don't have any alternatives. But the men have basketball, football, hockey, and baseball. And so tennis has got to get smart in America and really compete for the 8 and 10-year-old growing up. And how do you do that? Well, one thing, this is said, you know, from afar, I'm not in the USTA. I've been very close to them over the years, been a Davis Cup captain and all that, been on their committees. But, you know, they have 17 sections. They make $350 million net out of the US Open. and they spend 85% of it on the 17 sections. Well, they've got to make sure those sections are doing something to really get young players into the game, run young athletes, not just parents who play. You know, the Bryans grew up because their mother and father played.
Right.
I grew up and played a lot because my mother played. But how do you attract the young, uneducated, great athlete to tennis? And that's the $64 question that the USTA, in my judgment, has got to deal with and answer, and has not done that for 30 years. I mean, seriously, John, if you think about it today in the world, who is promoting tennis? In my judgment, there's one group that promotes tennis, certainly in America, effectively. That's called the Tennis Channel. If we didn't have the Tennis Channel, what would tennis look like on the media scale? Absurd.
You're singing my song. What if I attacked this entire premise and said we live in a global world, the economics are never going to work out. I mean, there are guys in the NBA that you and I have never heard of that will make more money than, you know, Roger Federer and Rafa Nadal in prize money anyway. The economic incentive is not going to be there. Why don't we just embrace this as an international sport? Why don't we support Dominic Thiem and get to know Tsitsipas and stop with this idea that American fans will only root for American players, because it just is not trending that way. And it's great that you've got the Williams sisters and Coco Gauff and a much different picture on the women's side. But the USTA, instead of trying to generate these champions, and the track record there in the last 20 years is nothing to be proud of, why don't we just put all of this muscle behind getting Americans to appreciate tennis, period? And if the guy is from Serbia, or the guy is from Greece, or the guy is from Russia or Germany, so be it. That's what tennis looks like. Let's stop with this nationalism that's also at odds with this global world we live in. What do you say to that strategy?
Well, I say to that, that's exactly what the Tennis Channel is doing every day. We just need to broaden it to other cable networks and other sports networks. I think
the Tennis Channel.
I think it's hard to do, though, John. I think what you're proposing is very difficult to do, because people naturally think, oh, well, we need American players in an individual American sport to be popular. And the NBA has proven differently, even in a team sport. You know, there's over 104 non-American NBA players today. Nobody realizes that. David Stern was a genius in doing that. They have the best players in the world playing the best sport,
yeah.
And it's the number one or two sport in the world after football.
But I would say the critical difference there is that the games are played here, and we love, you know, Jokic and Dirk Nowitzki and the Greek Freak, but he's playing in Dallas and Milwaukee, and it's not that, you know, if these international players were taking the events with them, which is what we see in tennis, and suddenly half the NBA season was going on in Western Europe, what would happen to fandom? I mean, to me, the big loss in the U.S. is not the lack of American players, it's the lack of American events. And if the NBA could be 100% foreign players, but if they're still playing in Salt Lake City, it's going to be more popular than a sport that's played offshore, at least in the U.S. What do you think?
Well, you're absolutely right. If you look back to in the 70s and 80s, I mean, we had at one stage, we had 26 American tournaments on the tour. And today we have about 7. I mean, that your point is very well taken. If you're going to have a popular sport, you got to have a lot of events in the nation and the country where you're promoting the sport. And we have failed miserably on the prize money basis and the competitiveness basis. And you're right, we've always placed the emphasis on, well, we need more American stars, as opposed to we need bigger events and bigger prize money. And that's one place, I think, very effectively, that the integration of the men and women on a tour could benefit America. Because America, the parity, the gender parity, is a big wave in America, as you know, and it's certainly happening and has happened much more than many other countries. So I think the USTA should be thinking about creating more events, but they're not. The people who create events are either, agencies like IMG, ProServe, or Octagon. That's where we were effective. We were creating events. And so that's one good way to build the sport again, but it takes real leadership at the top of the USTA. The biggest problem they've had for years is a new president every 2 years. There's no leadership there. They're just caretakers, really. They mean well, and they're nice people, but they're here today and gone tomorrow in 2 years. You really got to build. I mean, that's one of the hopes of, I think, Emerge, ATP, and WTA. If you had strong leadership at the top, which today you do, let's bring them together and create some co-ed events, as many as we could get in America. That's one way to go.
Let me ask you one more question, which I don't mean this as cocktail party talk. I'm dead serious on this. Where do you get your energy? I mean, I see you all over the world. You could very easily and gracefully be playing tennis and living the good life, and I see you grinding it out on shuttle buses to someone who still cares about the sport. I don't mean this as blowing smoke, and I don't mean this as a throwaway line. And in all seriousness,
it's a sport, John, that I really have always loved, not just as a player. When I started my own law firm, Del Craig Offenders and Benton, in 1970, I was the first tennis agent in the world. And what I really wanted to do, I had played the tour for 6 or 7 years, played Wimbledon 7 times, played the U.S. Open about 12 times. And I just wanted to see the sport of tennis become like golf or other sports. In other words, when I played, everyone would say, and I retired in 66, the game went open in 68. So people said to me, well, what do you do besides play tennis? Because I was an amateur. What do you do besides play tennis? That's what every guy was asked. Jack Kramer came out and said, I was a paid amateur. He got paid a lot of expenses. Right. I want to change that. My goal in 1970 was, I want to see my younger brother, 10 years younger, played the tour, Dick, say, I'm a professional tennis player. That's what drove me in the 70s and 80s when everything was starting up, was really to create a pro tour. That's happened now. Energy-wise, I guess I'm very, very lucky. My genes are great. My mother lived to be 103, John, so hopefully I still have a lot of energy. I try to take care of myself, and I've got a wonderful wife and 2 twin daughters, and they give me a lot of love and support. And it's just, I love the sport. I love all sport, actually, but I love tennis too. And I just, you know, Jack Kramer was my hero. I think he did more for the sport than anybody. And if I can be helpful and create something better for those who follow, that really motivates me and drives me. And as long as I have good health and work with good people, you know, I like the very much, as you know, the Ken Solomons of the world and the Jack Kramers of the world, the people that really matter in growing the sport. That's what motivates me.
Right. Well, we're lucky to have you. This is a great, good place to wrap. I really appreciate this. This was fun conversation.
Thanks, John. It's been very enjoyable.
Always a pleasure. All right. Take care of yourself. Enjoy your family. And maybe we'll see you in person one of these days.
For sure. And stay well yourself.
You as well. Thanks, Donald.
Okay. Thanks to Donald Dell. Fun conversation. Donald remains a real pillar in the sport. He's sort of the Fabrice Santoro in terms of being a master of tennis angles. And we will see whether these merge tours will happen. Again, I think we're all saying the same thing. Great idea. Let's attack those devils in the details. Thanks, as always, this week to Jamie. Have a good holiday week, everyone. If you're in the U.S., have a good week. If you are not in the U.S., keep the guest suggestions coming. We got a great guest suggestion the other day that we are trying to make happen. Thanks to Dale S. for that one. So have a good week, everyone. Join me in mourning that this would be Wimbledon week. Hopefully we'll be back with the next major on the calendar, the U.S. Open. Meanwhile, stay healthy, stay well, subscribe, leave a review, follow us, get this wherever podcasts are bought and sold, and have a good week, everyone. All right, take care.